Good evening. I'm pleased to welcome you to the first of a series of eight distinguished public lectures being given in conjunction with a course entitled Gateways to Emergent Behavior in Science and Society that I'm David Pines, and my co-organizer, co-teacher of the course is Alex Dobrotsky, who's sitting there. We're very pleased that Ivan Smolia could be with us this evening. His title, as you can see, is Smart Materials for a Sustainable Future. Ivan is a condensed matter theorist who got his degree at his PhD at Kent State following an undergraduate career in Lviv, and I guess a year or so there before making the transition to Ohio. And he made a most successful transition. After getting his PhD, he was a postdoc for a year there with working on liquid crystals. He then received a very early postdoctoral appointment from the Institute for Complex Adaptive Matter, which is one of the sponsors of this series, ICAM, and it's one of its directors is sitting in the front row, Daniel Cox. Ivan is a major ICAM success story. He worked on a joint postdoc between Kent State and the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, and then from that position went to his present position as a tenure-track assistant professor at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He's received a number of quite significant honors. Let me mention two of them, which are really quite special. Well, they're more than two. Let me mention a half dozen of them. Okay. After getting his ICAM fellowship, which is quite a special thing in and of itself, because the idea of the fellowship is that you serve as a kind of exchange boson, an exchange particle between two different research groups, often in two different fields and at two different institutions. And this he had a wonderful time doing. After that, he became a senior investigator of the Liquid Crystals Materials Research Center. He received an award from NSF DARPA Photonics Technology, and you'll Technology Access Program, no less, and went on to get an NSF Career Award. He was selected as a founding fellow of RASEI, whatever that might be, what it could be, Royal Astronomical Society for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, right? Okay. And then a Presidential Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers, PCAS. And finally, he's been selected for the National Academy of Sciences, Kavli Frontiers of Science Symposium. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Ivan as the first of our eight distinguished public lecturers.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, David, for this very nice introduction. I'm very honored and pleased to be here today. And, I hope I'll be able to share with you a story how smart materials could help us in achieving sustainable future. So RACI actually means Renewable and Sustainable Energy Institute, and in addition to being a physics professor at CU Boulder, I'm also a fellow of RACI. what I would like to start today from is to just remind you that this year, population of the global population achieved 7 billion, right? So you can see that population will further grow, and most of that growth is in developing countries, right? Now, the last billion of people added in 12 years, last 4 billion people have been added in 50 years, and 150 babies are born pretty much every minute, right? So why do I mention those facts? How are they related to renewable and sustainable energy and sustainable future? Well, obviously, newborn babies will be new consumers of energy. And if we take a look at the energy consumption, you can notice some interesting facts that in developed nations, the consumption of energy is actually 14 times or so larger than that in developing nations, right? So developed nations consume much more energy per capita as compared to developing nations. So this is fairly recent statistics, it does have important consequences because as population is growing further, and people around the globe want to have better lives, they will consume more and more energy, right? So we do need, therefore, to satisfy those energy needs. Now, another interesting look at statistics that we can take is shown in here, where we have a comparison between CO2 emissions of United States and China, right? And so you can see in the United States, the emissions are somewhat flat during the last several decades. Those are emissions per capita, but in China, we do see some growth, right? Which is pretty significant. Recently, China actually surpassed the United States in terms of the CO2 emissions. Those are the numbers in kilotons for China and U.S. And as you can see from this graph in here, the CO2 emissions of China are growing very fast. This is pretty steep curve that we can see in here. Those are overall emissions, right, due to country with over a billion population. This map in here shows the statistics of CO2 emissions around the globe. You can see that the other big emitter is India, for example, and in there too, we see quite significant growth of CO2 emissions. Now, we have therefore a really big challenge, right? Because on one hand, we do need to have to satisfy those needs of growing needs of energy of growing population, right, and population that will want to have better and better life and therefore will demand more energy. So energy consumption will grow significantly. This is some statistics or some projections taken from a PNAS article by Nate Lewis and Nocera. And so you can see that the energy needs in 2050, global energy needs, will be roughly 28 terawatt. Right? Now, who remembers what tera means? Is it 10 to power 12? Very good, yeah? So this is a huge number, right? It's 12 zeros there. And this is what we consume right now, right? So we need to increase, so the energy consumption may increase significantly several times in just several decades. So we do need to be able to satisfy those energy needs if we will have them. And at the same time, we should satisfy them in a climate neutral or carbon neutral way, right? In such a way that that's sustainable, right? And so if you take a look, a closer look what we have on this slide, so the big fraction of the energy comes from oil, gas, coal, right? So perhaps we can, even if we keep those non-renewables in the energy distribution in 2050, we need to fill in this part and what those energy sources will be. As I already mentioned, for sustainable future, we need to have carbon neutral or climate neutral energy sources. And the other approach, you might say, could be sustainable too if we were to simply decrease the energy needs that are projected in this graph, right? So suppose we would develop energy efficient technologies that would allow us to consume, say, half of that projected number in here in 2050, right? And that would help a lot too. And so this therefore brings me to this slide in here where I think we have two different approaches in addressing this grand challenge related to energy and a sustainable future. One is new energy sources that would be climate neutral or carbon neutral. The other one is related to better, more efficient use of energy, right? And so in my presentation, in terms of the new sources of energy, I'll mostly focus on photovoltaics and in particular on quite unconventional photovoltaics that we would not think that much about just several years ago, right? So those will be mostly not just regular solar cells that we already see on roofs of our buildings and also in big solar parks like those you can see in here, but the solar cells that can be plastic and very inexpensive, but yet produce significant amounts of electricity and satisfy our needs. In terms of addressing the problems related to energy efficiency, I think a lot can be done, right? Because if you simply recall that just several years ago, we all were using CRT displays, right? Nowadays, we mostly use liquid crystal displays, and those are much, much more efficient. However, there is still big room for improvement in efficiency of liquid crystal displays and other technologies related to everyday devices that we use in our everyday life. The other example that I will focus in my talk is related to the efficiency of energy use in buildings, right? So this is nothing else but just infrared picture of a house. And what it tells us that a lot of energy is lost through windows, right? And also through doors and walls of the buildings. If we were to able make those buildings much more efficient, right, then we would be able to save a significant fraction of energy. So in a building, 30% of energy is lost through windows on average in the United States, a significant fraction. and so, this picture is taken probably during the winter time, right? If you were to take a similar picture during the summer, you would realize that windows are a big problem during the summer too, because the heat leaks to the buildings and then we need to use a lot of conditioning as well, again, spending energy. If we were to be able to control the flow of energy through windows, we would be able to save a lot of energy. Now, how do we approach So let me get to some details. So what I'm showing here is a solar radiation spectrum, right? The black curve that you can see shown in here is the black body radiation, and the sunlight that you, the spectrum of the sunlight that you would be able to measure at the top levels of atmosphere would be the yellow part. Now, what gets to the Earth is shown here in red, and obviously you probably know that those lines you can see in here is due to absorption of different gases and water vapor in the atmosphere. Now, sun provides apparently enough energy to satisfy all our energy needs. If we were to be able to harvest this energy and convert it to usable sources of energy and electricity. Now, however, how do we do it, again, in a sustainable way? So the conventional silicon solar cells are the most common approach, right? And it's an approach that has been around for quite some time already. We can see those solar cells on the roofs. We use them in calculators, for example. They are already very mature, very efficient technology, right? We need to accept the fact that this is really very good, very mature technology. Now, the graphs you can see in here show us where the solar cells, conventional solar cells, are manufactured. A lot of them are manufactured, you can see, in China, Taiwan, Japan, in Asia, right? And this chart in here tells us where mostly those solar cells are being installed. And an interesting observation that you probably notice immediately, over 50% of them are in Germany, right? Now, not that many in China, which would be the major manufacturer of the solar cells, right? Not that many actually in USA. So these statistics on this slide probably tells you already that technology itself is not the only thing that we need in order to make those technologies work for sustainable future, right? So the reason why such a large number of photovoltaic solar cells is installed in Germany is because the government has a lot of subsidies and support for the use of solar cells in this country. One of the barriers related to installing a solar cell on your roof or other uses of solar cells is the initial investment, right? Because the solar cells are pretty expensive, and you need to invest in the very beginning a significant amount by purchasing a solar cell and installing it, right? And then it will pay back somewhat over a pretty long period of time. Now, if you were to calculate the cost of electricity that's produced by photovoltaic solar cells and compare that to other sources of energy, for example, due to coal and gas, you would realize that the solar electricity due to conversion of solar energy is still much more expensive, right? However, the price is decreasing with time. You can see that projections show that even if nothing significant happens in the development of new technologies, the solar cells, the electricity produced by solar cells, will still become less expensive eventually, right? Compared to the electricity due to coal or gas sources. one of the reasons is because the more cells, the more solar cells are manufactured, the less expensive they become. And so these statistics in particular in here gives us an evidence of this. However, there is a big hope that new technologies will allow us to achieve those goals even faster, right? And further decrease the cost of electricity due to conversion of solar energy. Now, before I proceed in discussion what could be those different kinds of solar cells, let me just give you a brief introduction into what is the efficiency of solar cells. So typically, it's calculated as a general electrical power divided by the incident light power. So in other words, how much of the solar energy you actually convert to the usable electrical power or usable energy in the form of electricity. And so 100% of efficiency is typically not possible to achieve, right? the 20% efficiency is achievable in commercial solar cells that are based on silicon. However, this is expensive material which makes the solar cells expensive, which requires very significant initial investment, and therefore many people simply can't afford. Therefore, we do not install as many solar cells as we possibly could, right? it's possible to have 33% of efficiency in the space-grade solar cells, but again, those are extremely expensive, and you would not install them on your rooftop of your house. Now, the multicrystalline silicon solar cells are much less expensive. Their efficiency is roughly 10% only, right? The solar cells made of this polycrystalline silicon are relatively affordable, and therefore there is no need of that large initial investment, right? So this is important to keep. The 10% of efficiency is good enough for you to use the solar cells pretty much on daily basis and eventually pay back for the costs of energy, costs of the solar cell in the long term. So this number is already very good, right? Now, photovoltaic principle is depicted here in this slide. I know that most of you have physics background, as I understand, or science background, background in sciences, and I hope that you know about P-type and N-type semiconductors and the P-N junction that is formed in here in the solar cell. Then we have electrodes. So one of the electrodes is mostly transparent to let the sunlight get into the solar cell and generate the carriers at the p-n junction, which then go to the electrodes, and we can use to use the solar cell to power bulbs or other devices. Again, we have in here the negative electrode, the positive electrode, the p-n junction, which is essentially the interface between differently doped semiconductors, the donor and acceptor, and the p-n junction is the interface at which we generate the carriers. Now, as I already mentioned, the main problem why we don't use those type of solar cells that widely is the initial investment, right? So in here, this graph in here shows you the cost of the fuel investment and also operation maintenance for different sources of energy, and in particular electricity. And you can see that the initial investment is huge in the case of solar cell. And although we don't have any spendings for fuel, and the maintenance is not that expensive, but this initial investment makes it very difficult to deploy the conventional solar cell technology. So if you were to be able to produce very inexpensive solar cell, this technology, you know, would be on pretty much every roof, and you know, there would be a significant breakthrough in terms of using more sustainable forms of energy, in particular.
I just want to make a point that I've heard very different numbers than the numbers you're showing here. So that one has to be, there are a lot of numbers thrown around often biased towards what particular energy you want to use, right? And in particular, this shows wind is more expensive than the others. Typically, wind is believed on a large wind farm at least to be pretty competitive, like at, you know, 6 cents per kilowatt hour, something like that. And nuclear, because of capital investment, because of the infrastructure costs up front, is usually more expensive. So this depends on how you've done the estimates.
Absolutely.
So I just want to throw a note of caution out there.
Yeah. I agree, because there are different wind farms, right? And it highly depends on many different factors. I totally agree. Well, just one main point I want to make in here is that, you know, the deployment of solar cells would be much easier if there would be no, if the initial investment would not be that high. Right.
That's
agreed. Yeah, and so I want to show this statistics which tells us about the efficiency of the solar cells, different kinds of solar cells, right? So far what I showed to you was the very conventional ones that we all are very familiar with, but there are many different other solar cell technologies. The one I will focus on today is actually in the very bottom in here. It's called organic photovoltaics or plastic solar cells, right? So you can see that efficiencies of those solar cells started really low. And however, there is a significant improvement of efficiency of plastic solar cells during the last several years. And although they are much lower than what we get, for example, for single crystal silicon, but you probably already realize we will not need that significant initial investment in the case of those solar cells. My colleagues at RACI often like to show this chart, that this graph that I have in here, where they distinguish three different generations of solar cells, right? The first generation is the solar cells we have discussed based on the single crystal silicon and other polycrystalline silicon. The second generation that you can see in here includes organic photovoltaics, includes cadmium telluride, includes diasynthesized solar cells. You can see that the total cost related to those solar cells can be much lower, right? Although the efficiencies are typically not that high, you still can keep the cost fairly low. And so those are the solar cells, you know, many people are developing currently, right? But they also include the third generation solar cells, those include hot carriers, multiple exciton generation, or MAG for short, multi-junction solar cells. And so their efficiency can be much higher. They can also produce relatively inexpensive electricity. All right, and so now what I want to mention is that some of thin film solar cells, like organic photovoltaics, there are different types of solar cells that do not necessarily fall into the second generation or third generation. They are somewhere in between, right? Because they can take advantage of multiple different processes that we discuss in here. And so, as you can see, although the conventional solar cells that we have here in the first generation of photovoltaics still give us electricity that's more expensive, as you can compare it to the electricity obtained due to fossil fuels. the second generation and third generation solar cells will be able to provide much less expensive electricity, therefore more competitive with the other sources of energy that are less carbon neutral, right? And so today I want to, in my first part of talk, I want to discuss the organic photovoltaic solar cells that can be very inexpensive because they are made out of materials that can be solvent processed materials that are quite inexpensive. So I'll discuss you the recent developments in the technology and in science related to those solar cells. But what I want to start from is give you a little bit of historical background because several decades ago, when people first started using organic materials for solar cells, they were able to produce efficiencies only of about 1%, right? Very low efficiencies. So the solar cells they were using at that time were pretty much mimicking the conventional solar cells because, again, one would have a p-n junction in this case by using different organic compounds. I don't know if you can see the chemical structure of the examples I wanted to provide in there, the p-n junction, which is very similar to conventional solar cells in this particular case, was between two films of chemical compounds that you can see in here. The efficiencies were pretty low. So in a sense, this was quite discouraging for some time because the process related to generation of electricity by such a p-n junction solar cell made of two organic compounds is fairly complicated. It starts, so obviously, from light absorption and formation of exciton, then exciton diffusion to the donor acceptor interface, the charge transfer and formation of charge transfer complex at the interface, charge separation into free hole and electron, and then charge transfer to the electrodes and charge injection into the electrodes, right? So the efficiency of this process was fairly low. Now, in the next generation of the organic photovoltaic solar cells, which were first demonstrated in 1995, there was a very different approach adopted. Instead of forming a p-n junction at the flat interface, what was done in this case is a bulk heterojunction, right, between the donor and acceptor materials. And so in this case, what we have is, again, two electrodes, and then here is a glass substrate. One of the electrodes is obviously transparent. And then we have interconnected network of the donor and acceptor, right? And so the scales, the length scales in here, are on the order of tens of nanometers, right? And so then we again have absorption of light, the generation of exciton, diffusion of excitons to the interface between donor and acceptor, separation, and eventually this result in generation of electricity. Now, what's important to understand is that this network is indeed interconnected, and we have sort of highways for electrons and holes generated in different parts of this bulk heterojunction. So this was very quite difficult to achieve, and to some extent it was it was achieved to a large extent by accident, right? And so what was realized is that the fullerene is a very good acceptor and can separate from the polymers, many polymers that can act as donors and form those interconnected networks on the tens of nanometer length scales, which then resulted in much better efficiencies, as we will see a little bit later. Now, if you were to now take freeze fracture cryogenic electron microscopy image, you would be able to see what we depict in those schematics, right? So we have those fibrillar structures of the polymer, which in this particular plastic solar cell is P3HT, this particular polymer, right? So whatever you have in parentheses with number N is a unit that's repeated N times in the polymer structure, right? And then the acceptor is PCBM. It's essentially a fullerene with this structure. And so if you were now to filter the image, energy filter the image for sulfur, you again would see that the phase separation between the two components is on nanometer scales, right? And so
can't read the white scale bar there. So what is the white scale bar?
I believe it's 100 nanometers.
100
nanometers. And so the length scale between the phase-separated domains is very important. And so typically, it has to be optimized to be roughly two times the exciton diffusion length, right? Because if this length scale is much larger, then the excitons will not diffuse to interface and the charges will be lost. The domain size and topology must also inhibit the carrier recombination. So yes, there is an optimum size, which as I already mentioned, is roughly the two times of the excedent diffusion. when the domain size is too large, then we have poor exciton dissociation. When domain size is too small, we have excessive recombination. And both of those two extremes are not good. So there is an optimum domain size which can be achieved by processing the PCBM, P3HT mixtures by different solvents and achieving the phase separation just on the right length scales, right? And so ideally, essentially, we would want to have morphology of the solar cell that's depicted in here, right, where we would have channels running through the cell thickness, and we would have acceptor and donor domains with the lateral size comparable to the exciton diffusion. Very common approaches in fabrication and design of the solar cells include, as I already mentioned, the donor materials, which are typically polymers similar to the ones I'm showing in here, and then acceptor materials, which almost universally would involve fullerene C60 or C70, as I'll show a little bit later. It turns out C70 is working a little bit better than C60. Because the donor and acceptor parts of the bulk heterojunction phase separate, we do have some sort of highways for the charges then to go to the electrodes. Although the typical heterojunction probably looks something like this, you know, this would be obviously most ideal. But this is the best, you know, one can do so far. As I already mentioned, the C60 and C70, currently C70 are most common acceptor materials for the bulk heterojunction solar cells. This shows us the development, which is fairly recent in the field of plastic solar cells, where currently plastic solar cells can last fairly long period of time can be produced fairly easily in form of flexible thin films like the ones you can see in here. If you look at what happens with the efficiency of plastic solar cells, there is a dramatic growth of efficiency during the last several years. I was showing you that, two decades ago, the efficiency standard for plastic solar cells was 1% or so. You can see that already in 2009, we had roughly 6.4. 2009, a little bit later, in the end of the year, was already 7.9. In the mid of last year, 10.5 efficiency, which, as you can see, is comparable to the efficiency of polycrystalline silicon, has been achieved, right? And so what's also important to see in here is that those good efficiencies are actually achieved by companies, not in the research labs, because the companies are highly motivated to produce products, right, that would then, do well on the market. And in all of those recent advancements, the acceptor material that was used was universally PCBM C70, shown in here. And this is a press release related to this record efficiency of 10.5% that we have discussed. So let us take a quick look how the plastic solar cells work, the bulk heterojunctions work. So you already recognize the basic structure of the plastic solar cell. that we discussed before that involves the transparent electrode and the whole transport layer and the transparent substrate in here. But now, somewhere in the bulk of the material in here, we have an event of absorption that then results in diffusion of the resulting excitant to the interface between the donor and acceptor, which results in charges the hole and the electron that are then migrating to the electrodes and resulting in the electricity that we can use for the purposes, all kinds of purposes. And so this slide in here essentially summarizes the structure of the plastic solar cells. And the two materials that you can see are most typical materials, the PCBM and PCHT, the very typical materials of organic photovoltaic plastic solar cells. I have to mention that you know, some of those record deficiencies due to the companies that I showed before might have been obtained with different materials. You know, they are not necessarily always revealed, you know, what their technology is based on. Okay, all right. So now, one important thing to mention is that the fabrication of plastic solar cells is much easier than fabrication of conventional silicon solar cells, because you don't need any sort of fabrication steps in vacuum. You don't need hard metal deposition onto organic layers. So one can individually optimize different layers and can also obtain self-encapsulated device. It's compatible with the flexible substrates that we can use, and in particular in here, we show that one can do lamination of the organic photovoltaic solar cells to achieve the flexible solar cell films. There are different ways of different structures of devices, the normal and inverted structures that you can see in here that have different layer structure. But I'm thinking that maybe I'll skip the details right now just because we already spent a significant fraction of the lecture. Instead, I will want to show a couple more examples of the industrial developments of plastic solar cells. So on this slide, you can see some of the major players in the plastic solar cell industry, and in particular, one of the major players is Konarka, that has a big plant in New Bedford in Massachusetts. And you can see the manufacturing lines where the plastic solar cells are being manufactured in here. Now, you can buy many products with plastic solar cells. In particular, in Denver Airport, on the way here, I was able to see such Eco Traveler solar backpack that you see on this slide. And, you know, it can generate electricity and charge your laptop or phone while you are traveling. There are plastic.
How easily do these get damaged?
How is it to damage? Well, I don't have personal experience, but yeah, well, you know, it's pretty durable material, I think. You know, the plastic films used here should be pretty good, you know, long-lasting.
But under, what is one of the concerns is that under solar radiation, how long do they last?
Well, that is not a major problem at all. You know, they have been tested for, you know, like you have seen on one of the slides, much larger than a year, much more than a year, right? And it means different, might mean 5 years in one case, 10 years in the other case. Obviously, many of those things are just being developed.
Right.
So they have not been tested in real conditions. They have been somehow tested by those companies in, you know.
It's just that one of the critiques that's sometimes made, which I know the organic photovoltaic people push back on, is that the durability of the organic photovoltaics is not as long, although they are very cheap, whereas silicon photovoltaics in the last 20, 40, 50 years perhaps. So even though they're more expensive, you may get a, you know, better
payout in
the long run. That's one of the arguments. I'm not
saying it's right, but it's
one of the arguments.
Well, one of the questions is, are they cheap enough to replace easily once a year, like battery?
Exactly.
Yeah.
When they
yeah.
get to that level, who cares?
Yeah.
Do these,
like,
exhibit, does this
type exhibit this kind of fall off in efficiency that then saturates? I forget what the effect is, but there's a classic thing that happens to some of the solar cells where they drop and then.
As a function of what?
Saturated.
As a function of exposure to light.
Oh, exposure, yeah.
What's that phenomenon? It says, it's a German name on it or something, I think. You know what I mean?
Essentially burnout.
Yeah, I mean, as a function of time, I think that in many of those cases, the efficiency still would have to be tested, but it does not change significantly, right? It doesn't go down order of magnitude or something like that. But there might be some minor changes. All right, so in here you can see some other commercial available products and, you know, plastic solar cells on tents, on parking lots, and
that's a bus stop, I think.
Bus stop station, exactly, here, parking lot. Also as part of decoration of buildings. Right? So if those get so inexpensive that, you know, you can spend $100 and just decorate your house and that still generates electricity for you, you know, why, you know, if you even have to replace it every year or so, you know, not a big problem, right? All right, so it would be still great to push the efficiency of the plastic solar cells even further up, right? Because currently, those 10% are absolute records. Most of the products you will be able to buy will be actually maybe like 3, 4, 5% efficient, right? Because not everybody can compete with Mitsubishi Corporation that got this record. And, you know, it does not also mean that in every single cell they will sell to customers, you will have that efficiency. Now, what are the ways of further improving the efficiency of solar cells? One of the approaches that pursued by quite a few people recently, in particular by Zhao Van Hellahemat at NREL, with whom we collaborate, is to use plasmonic metal nanoparticles in order to enhance the photoconversion processes by means of those nanoparticles. Right, and so if, you know, typically in the solar cells that I was showing to you, the thickness is on the order of 100 nanometers, right? Obviously, if you were to be able to increase that thickness, you would be able to absorb more light, right? So that more light could be potentially converted to more electricity. But because the distance between electrodes is much larger. Then if your cell gets too sick, then there is lots of recombination, and the cell becomes less efficient. Now, instead of increasing the thickness, if you were to be able to simply increase absorption and conversion to electricity that way, that would be much more efficient way of doing it, and the metal nanoparticles can mediate this process because they can enhance by many orders of magnitude the electric field of light as it's being absorbed, and you can even have multi-photon absorption in those cases. One can generate nanoparticles that would have surface plasmon resonance in different parts of optical spectrum that's of interest from the standpoint of view of the absorption of sunlight. and so in order to be able to do it, one, for example, could use nanorods that have different aspect ratio, and as you were to increase the aspect ratio, then the longitudinal surface plasmon resonance peak would simply shift toward the infrared part of the optical spectrum, right? And so in terms of the use of the plasmonic nanoparticles, one can adopt a couple different approaches. Those couple images are actually taken from a recent article by in Nature Materials by Atwater and Polman, where they discussed how the plasmonic nanoparticles could be used directly to enhance the field, right? And so for the conventional solar cell, they would be right at the p-n junction. In the case of plastic solar cells, they would be at the interface between the donor and acceptor regions, right, of the bulk heterojunction, doing the similar kind of function. But they can be also used as sources of forward scattering the light trapping by plasmon wave guiding, and in all of those three examples, they can further enhance efficiency by keeping the cell, the plastic solar cell thickness small enough and yet have a significant amount of light absorbed in the material, right? Because, for example, if you have the forward scattering process like the one in here, the light pass within the solar cell increases, and that increases the chance of absorption within the the solar cell. Okay, so far we discussed how the solar cells, in particular plastic solar cells, could be used for as alternative sources of carbon-neutral sources of energy, right? Climate-neutral sources of energy. What I want to discuss in the remaining part of my lecture, and let me just quickly check how I'm doing in time. Okay, all right. I would like to discuss the energy saving and harvesting technologies related to the use of liquid crystal. And just a couple examples we will be able to focus on is more efficient displays, windows with tunable transparency, and that includes transparency in visible part of spectrum and also in the infrared part of spectrum. Combination, potential combination of solar cells and tunable windows, combination of solar cells and displays, right? And so I'll discuss in a little bit more details, you know, what approaches could be adopted in order to increase efficiency, further increase efficiency of our displays, right, which includes, for example, laptop computer that would make the batteries last even much, much longer. But before I proceed with that, I would like to give you a little bit of introduction into liquid crystals. Right, so liquid crystals are unique states of matter that stand between isotropic fluids and crystalline solids, because they combine some degrees of ordering, which can be orientational ordering only or partial positional ordering, with the fluidity, right? So they can flow like liquids, but at the same time, they do have orientational and partial positional ordering too. Sometimes just orientational or partial positional ordering as well. The liquid crystals are typically comprised of anisotropic building blocks like rod-like molecules, disc-like molecules, banana-shaped molecules, molecules that are not very symmetric, not that have highly anisotropic shapes. Now, the interactions between those building blocks often lead to formation of the liquid crystal phases, like the nematic liquid crystal phase and columnar liquid crystal phase that you can see in here. Right? And it's the structure of those building blocks that largely determines what kind of behavior you obtain for those materials. And so the very common, most conventional liquid crystals are called nematic liquid crystals that you can see in here, where you have no positional ordering at all, right? But you do have orientational ordering. The molecules are free to move with respect to each other, but they do need to preserve this average orientational ordering being parallel to each other as they flow, the material flows and the molecules move with respect to each other. And so this liquid crystal is formed by rod-shaped molecules. And the one you can see in here is formed by very different molecules, which are disc-shaped, right? And so in this case, however, you still can see that the average orientation of normals to those disc-shaped molecules is also the same for all of them, which is normal to the screen. Now, the molecules you can see in the very bottom part of the slide show the typical chemical compounds that are used to realize those phases, right? And the little R's in here stand for radicals, so can be, for example, hydrocarbon chains attached to such a core that you can see in here. Now, what's important also to mention is that one can have molecules with chiral carbon centers, like the one in here, which make those molecules losing their mirror symmetry. And therefore, they tend to assemble into so-called cholesteric phases, where locally the assembly of those molecules is very similar to that what we saw in the nematic phase. But as you would move along this helical axis, you would see them twisting with respect to each other and forming this helical structure where the distance over which they twist by 360 degrees is called cholesteric pitch, right? Now, obviously, the reason they're forming those structures is the lack of mirror symmetry, right? Which is, in this particular case of this molecule, due to presence of this carbon chiral center in here, the very similar molecule that does not have this chiral center is not showing the twisting structures. Right. Now, it's important to mention that this helical structure and tendency to twist can lead to a number of interesting phases that can form. For example, the so-called cholestatic blue phases, where the building block is the so-called double twist cylinder, where molecules twist from the center to periphery in all radial directions, right, by forming this double twist cylinder. And then you can imagine packing those double twist cylinders into cubic lattices, like the one you can see in here, and you can produce body-centered and face-centered cubic lattices this way. What you obtain as a result of packing of those double twist cylinders is a network of defects, right? Because you cannot fill in the entire volume of the unit cell perfectly by just double twist cylinders. You will have to produce defects or regions with reduced order in such a unit cell, and those are shown in here by the red lines. And they are in the regions where you have interconnection between the different double twist cylinders. However, what's important and interesting to mention here is that this periodicity in the cubic lattice of the blue phase or in cholestatic phase of liquid crystals can be comparable to the wavelengths of light, right? And so therefore you can have selective reflection of colors that you can see in here for those monocrystals of blue phase being formed as you would cool the material from high temperature when it would be in isotropic state to lower temperature. Very slowly you would form those kind of crystallites, right? And so the beautiful reflection colors in here, as I already mentioned, are due to selective reflections of polycrystals of this blue phase, right? Now, because those materials are in a liquid crystal state, we all know that we can switch the displays of liquid crystals by applying very low voltages of roughly 1 volt or so. We can switch liquid crystal the same way. We could do it also in here and eliminate the selective reflection or have it returning back. And therefore, perhaps that could be one way of controlling the transparency of windows, right? By controlling the selective reflection of light, and since the selective reflection is dependent on periodicity, which in cholestatic liquid crystals can be controlled by controlling cholestatic pitch, we can do it in either visible part of spectrum or in the infrared part of spectrum. But we will return to this point a little bit later during the lecture. However, the other class of materials that we already discussed before are polymers.
Sorry, Ivan, can I have 1 second? So the idea is to eliminate some radiative losses through the windows. But what about just heat transport through the windows? So, oh, I see. You combine like double pane windows and so on. Right. I mean, you make the windows as good as possible for insulation against heat transport, and you have this as an added feature for radiative, either trapping radiation in the wintertime or keeping it out in the summertime. Got it. Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Some sort of, when I lived in Arizona, films that you put on your window that absorb the transmission a lot without cutting down on the light too much. Reasonably effective and reasonably cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen them since.
I think you can still get them.
Yeah, so actually on the market there are quite a lot of films that are not switchable at all.
Especially in the wintertime.
But beauty of some of the approaches that can be provided by liquid crystals and liquid crystal polymer composites is that depending on the need, you could, you know, change the transparency in visible infrared. Pardon?
What's the technology in eyeglasses, the ones that darken as you go outside?
So there is e-tint, you mean those kind of?
The ones that change from being
transition.
Electrochromic ones?
There's no power supply to those, right? They just
don't, you know. Okay.
So there are the glasses with controlled transparency which are based on liquid crystal, and there is a company called Alpha Micron Inc. which develops those. So you can tune transparency, you know, from 100%, almost 100% to 10% or so, they can also produce plastic films that can be laminated in principle on the windows, right? But then, the only effect that you get in this case is you absorb light, which is then re-emitted, you know, the heat is re-emitted in different directions. So they you know, in that way, they are maybe a bit less efficient. But this technology related to the eyeglasses with tunable transparency, where you can also get different colors depending on the need, right, of the glasses, I think it's very mature. And you can buy skiing goggles, for example, and goggles like motorcycle goggles, helmets with those already. The mesogenic polymers that I want to show in here are also composed of anisotropic building blocks. Polymers, therefore, can also form a number of liquid crystal phases where you would have orientational ordering or also partial positional ordering of those building blocks, right? So the only difference compared to what we saw before is that now those mesogenic anisotropic units are interconnected with each other through the polymer network. and so I think I'm running a little bit faster than, let me see how much, 10 minutes. I probably need to run a little bit faster than I originally thought about. You can form a number of different liquid crystal phases from the polymer networks. And one interesting example is the so-called liquid crystal elastomers, where the mesogenic units are fairly loosely connected with each other in such a way that they can rotate, but they cannot move very far from each other. And therefore, there is mechanical coupling between orientational ordering the shape mechanical properties of the elastomers. And so, for example, when going from disordered state to liquid crystal ordered state, the shape of those can change, and therefore they are thought as candidates for artificial muscle applications, for example. One can obtain, for example, 300% of strain by changing the temperature when going from between isotropic and ordered pneumatic-like states. We all know about liquid crystals is that they are very responsive to external fields, right? As we already discussed before, typically they are formed by molecules that have molecular dipoles, right? And then when we apply external fields, we do have difference in dielectric constants between for electric field orientations parallel or perpendicular to the liquid crystal director, and we can use this coupling to switch liquid crystals, right? So because there is a difference between the electric constants, we can realign liquid crystals in fairly low electric field. In materials with positive dielectric anisotropy, we typically align the anisotropic molecules to be in field parallel to the field direction, while in materials with negative dielectric anisotropy, where epsilon parallel is smaller than epsilon perpendicular, measured perpendicular to liquid crystal director or molecular orientation direction, then the molecules and the liquid crystal director align perpendicular to the electric field direction. And so those approaches are therefore utilized in all kinds of liquid crystal displays, right? So the most simple display would then involve a liquid crystal cell where you have a layer of liquid crystal between two electrodes, and then as you apply electric field, the molecules tend to rotate. You know, if you have a material with positive dielectric anisotropy, tend to rotate toward the field direction, which then changes the optical response, because if you place such a liquid crystal film between crossed polarizers, then you can tune the transmission of light this way, right? And so now the other form of a display that we can see in here is when you treat the surfaces of the liquid crystal cell in such a way that molecules at the opposite substrates tend to align in perpendicular directions, right? So in this direction at this surface and in this direction at this surface of the confining glass plates of liquid crystal cell. When you place such a liquid crystal cell between crossed polarizers again, you can have either off state or on state, depending on the alignment of polarizers. As you apply electric field, then it goes to the opposite state, right? Because at no field, the polarization of light is following the rotation of liquid crystal director in this twisted geometry, while when you turn the field on, the molecules in the liquid crystal director align parallel to the electric field, and therefore no light can pass through the cross polarizers, or if you have parallel polarizers, then all light passes through, right? And so this is another conventional widespread display mode that we typically utilize. And what we have is shown in here on those schematics, again, something that I just discussed, this following of polarization of light, of linearly polarized light, as it passes through the liquid crystal film in such a display, right? Now, what you realize by looking at those display modes is that in all of them, we use polarizing films, right? So what that practically means is that at least 50% of backlight is lost, right? Just because of presence of those displays. Because the way those display modes operate is by using polarized light, right? And yet another type of display mode is shown in here, where we have in-plane electrodes that are on the only on one substrate of the liquid crystal display or liquid crystal cell, and then initial orientation of the liquid crystal director or molecules is at some angle like 45 degrees with respect to the patterned electrodes that you have in here, when you then apply electric field, you rotate liquid crystal director, and with that you change response and the amount of light that's passing through the liquid crystal pixel in the display, right? But again, in order to make this display function, you again need two polarizing thin films that cause significant losses in light. One more example, you know, which again utilizes the polarizers is probably the most widely spread liquid crystal display mode called PVA mode, or patterned vertical alignment mode, where you know, you have initially vertical alignment, but this material is now with negative dielectric anisotropy, right? So those molecules want to align perpendicular to electric field lines when you apply electric field. And so as you apply electric field, therefore they tilt in different directions and let light pass through the system of two cross polarizers, which they don't in the off state when they are perfectly aligned normally to the liquid crystal cell of the display. And so in this case, they pass and you know, light leaks through the liquid crystal display. But again, 50% of that light has been lost, right? So we just reviewed pretty much all major modes of display operation that are currently there. And you can see that 50% of your backlight produced in the display is simply lost because of presence of two polarizing films. And so the question is, well, what if we were to be able to somehow recycle that light, either convert it back to electricity, or maybe avoid usage of polarizing films that would improve the efficiency of such a display. And so maybe I'll skip this one, but just because we are running out of time, but one way of achieving this goal is by using the so-called the gas hose display. And there are different modes of operation of those where you can use just one polarizer or no polarizers at all. And so the idea in here is that one uses the dye molecules in the liquid crystal itself, then because those are dichroic dye molecules, the absorption of light depends on orientation of those molecules with respect to the direction of incidence of light. And so a lot of light would be absorbed, for example, in this case when you have polarized incident light and with dichroic dye molecules having their transition dipoles of absorption parallel to the polarization direction. While if you apply field and align all of them perpendicular to the substrates, those dye molecules pretty much do not absorb at all, and they let the light passing through, right? And so now you can have either one kind of dye in the liquid crystal or different kinds of dyes, and with that you can change the color of the light transmitted through it. So in the most conventional displays, like the one I have, for example, in my laptop computer, we do have red, green, and blue pixels, right, which you would be able to see if you use magnifying glass or a simple microscope. If you were to have a right choice of dyes in those particular cases, in principle, you can also avoid the use of those filters too, right, which is, again, further improvement in efficiency. Then the other approach which can be utilized is called cholesteric reflective displays, which in principle do not require backlight because you utilize the incident light in this particular case. And so those can be switched between the helical structure, which reflects certain color, right? Because the periodicity of this helical structure can be controlled to have the Bragg reflection conditions met for different wavelengths of light, and therefore you can achieve different colors. Or you can also apply fields and cause the structures that strongly scatter light, so they would appear whitish in this particular case, right? And so again, the advantage is that in this case you don't require polarizers, and you don't require backlight essentially too. Obviously, this type of display would not be possible to use in a dark room, however, right? So it's not universally applicable for all kinds of applications. But so let me just rush through then. So I just had a couple examples of this was overview of the display technologies, but the examples I had are related to the bistable displays that do not require the use of electricity for applications such as signs, which can be switched only when you need to change the information on the sign. Only then you apply electricity. So those are some of the examples you can see in here. The other type of switching I wanted to discuss is the so-called polymer dispersed liquid crystals, where you have droplets of liquid crystal in a polymer matrix, and they act essentially as tunable fog, because you can control the refractive index mismatch between the droplet and polymer matrix. And in one case, when you apply field and align all of them, there is no mismatch, and therefore the film is transparent, while in the other case, when there is no field applied, there is a lot of mismatch in refractive index between the polymer and the liquid crystal droplets. They scatter a lot of light, so they appear milky, right? And so essentially you can tune the transparency this way and control the amount of light reflected or transmitted through such films, and they can be utilized as PDLC, polymer dispersed liquid crystal, smart windows that can control transparency, and also used as privacy windows too. The other type of polymer encapsulated liquid crystal displays developed by Ken Display Inc. is polymer encapsulated cholesteric liquid crystals, where the colors that are being reflected are again dependent on the cholesteric pitch of the cholesteric liquid crystal. And you can imagine having tiny droplets of liquid crystal in the polymer network that can be then switched. So this is just to show you the encapsulation of those, which involves UV curable polymers and results in tiny droplets of liquid crystals that phase separate from the polymer network and then can be encapsulated in the polymer matrix and switched by applying low voltage external fields. Now, currently you can buy those as skins that can change color, right? So I'm sure that it's probably not important for guys, but girls always want to match the color of the phone, with the skirt or something like that, or the bag. And so one way of doing it is to use those switchable skins, but again, the reflection can be controlled broadly in visible and infrared part of spectrum, and so you can envision controlling the transmission of energy flow in visible and infrared spectrum, and so they can be applied for a number of applications related to saving of energy due to windows and walls and so on and so on. And because you can also switch colors in a very nice way, those kind of systems are fairly compatible with, you know, new modern architectural design, so they might be attractive from this standpoint of view too. So here I had some examples of conventional, films that are used for improvement of efficiency of windows, but I just wanted to compare, but I guess I have to rush because, I also wanted to discuss one more example of using liquid crystals in Windows applications where one could actually harvest energy using Windows, right? And this would involve using dye molecules dispersed in a liquid crystal in between the glass surfaces, and also using a very efficient solar cell at the edges where the light would be re-emitting in the liquid crystal matrix and then being harvested by this quite efficient solar cell. There is a company in Netherlands which is commercializing this technology already, and one of my collaborators, Dick Brouwer from Eindhoven Institute of Technology, is very active in development of the system. So the idea is to route the light re-emitted by dyes to the solar cell, which is efficient and somewhere in here. And for that, again, we can use the polymer liquid crystal network that we have discussed before, that's polymerized and cross-linked. And because of the structure of liquid crystal, the light would be directed towards the solar cell rather than re-emitted backward. Obviously, you might ask me, what do we do with the part of solar spectrum in the infrared, and how can we control, because, no good dyes in that part of spectrum with absorption in that part of spectrum. But fortunately, many plasmonic particles, and examples are shown in here, can serve this purpose, and they can be aligned in liquid crystal. I just showed some examples of those in here. And in a similar way, they can be put into the cholesteric structured film. I don't have enough time to discuss in details the images I show in here, but the idea is you have a helical twisted structure where the alignment of gold nanoparticles, like nanorods that you have seen on the previous slide, follows the alignment of liquid crystal, and you can use them in a similar way as we use dyes, and therefore can control harvesting and flow of energy through windows, for example. So I just want to conclude by going back to this challenge slide related to 28 terawatt of energy by 2050, and I think that by using energy efficient technologies, we can significantly reduce projected use of energy by 2050, and also make sure that new sources of energy are more climate neutral or carbon neutral as well. Now, what I want to end with is with a short advertisement of a summer school that we organize in Boulder, which will take place from July 16 to August 11, so it's 4 weeks in Boulder, and it's designed for graduate students where you could learn much, much more about what we have discussed today and about many other types of solar cells and technologies. So the applications can be submitted pretty much right away. We do have some support for graduate students and ICAM, the Institute for Complex Adaptive Matter, is a sponsor of this summer school. I hope to see many of you in Boulder and will be happy to answer your questions. I will have a couple more slides, which I can probably leave in here in case if you will want to learn more about school. But in any case, I highly encourage that you visit the webpage and learn about it. Thank you for your attention.
Questions. Yvonne clearly could have gone on for another hour, probably. I admire the audience. You're all still here. It says a great deal to your powers of persuasion. I think you certainly got a twofer tonight, if not a threefer. Why don't we ask, let me ask the audience, let's have two questions.
I remember the name of that effect. It's the Stabler-Wronsky effect. Mm-hmm. Do you know that one?
No.
It's a... I think it's limited to a Marcus silicon. But it has to do with the interaction of the defects, maybe the hydrogen that is inevitably put in the Marcus silicon photovoltaic cell, and the efficiency goes down with exposure and then stabilizes. Mm-hmm. But I think there's certain defect character in these things you were talking about, and I wonder if anybody ever talked about it. Because one of the goals in the Marcus silicon cells is to minimize the Stabler-Wronsky effect, because it leads to a sort of running in of the, of the thing in which the efficiency goes down.
Regarding the organic photovoltaics, I'm wondering if you could give me a sense for the break-even point between the organic and the one that was next up. So I think that the organic, I don't remember what it was, maybe somewhere around 1-2% in efficiency, and then the next one was something like 10%, I'm not sure. But I'm curious about how they perform, as far as... when you break even with them.
You mean sort of the cost per kilowatt?
Yeah, exactly. It's like the efficiency to the cost. Like if one's, say, 1% efficiency and one's 10, but then, say, is one like 10 times more in price or 20 times more in price?
The first organic photovoltaic solar cells were only 1% efficient, right? And they were pretty much analogous to conventional, silicon-based solar cells, where you have P-type and N-type semiconductors and interface in between. So those were kind of modeled after the conventional solar cells. And you would have two organic layers, P-type and N-type, right, and an interface in between them. Nobody is pursuing this technology anymore because due to many reasons and due to the fact that your interface, the area of the interface is fairly small, right? Nobody is pursuing this technology right now. While the organic photovoltaics, which are based on bulk heterojunction, right, where you have this nanoscale phase-separated system, right, with the different domains being on the order of tens of nanometers, the interfacial area in there is much larger, right? And the efficiency that have been demonstrated, the record efficiency is 10.5%. So those are, I think currently most promising solar cells out of organic photovoltaics. Right now, we can compare organic photovoltaics with inorganic, amorphous silica-based. You can see that best organic photovoltaics already approached the efficiency of amorphous silica solar cell, right? They are much less expensive, but at the same time, the durability might be better in the case of amorphous silica, right? That's, you know, those studies here still need to be done, you know. So in short term, you know, the initial investment is much larger in the case of the amorphous silica solar cell. The plastic solar cells are much less expensive. But on the other hand, yes, you know, the amorphous silica-based solar cell will likely last much longer, right? So over long term, maybe they will break even, as you mentioned, right? And then it will be a question, what's important for the customer, consumers? Is it important to not to have this big initial investment, or, you know, is it important to be sure that over the course of many years of the that this solar cell works, it gives you best possible outcome, you know? So those questions are not that always easy to answer, because the costs depend also on how many cells you manufacture. Are they manufactured in China or, you know, in U.S.? You know, there are many different issues coming into play.
Thank you again, Ivan.
Thank you.